This is KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Welcome. You will find us this hour tweeting live at KUOW, and I hope you'll join us. We are going to begin this hour with your president, who has written his first budget. Donald Trump called this a skinny budget, and it is. It is skinny unless you're in the military or building a border wall. Otherwise, the budget pretty much cuts and cuts and cuts, and we're going to be analyzing those cuts all this week here on KUOW and NPR. But this is one place to start. Trump's budget includes a 20% cut to the National Institute of Health's $30 billion annual budget. That's what KUOW's politics reporter David Hyde is tracking today. David, welcome.
Hey.
What is that $30 billion cut to the NIH going to mean for patients and researchers in Washington state?
Well, of course, we don't really know yet. Congress, not the president, is going to pass this actual budget, and we don't know yet how the state will be affected. But we can say that in 2016, nearly $1 billion in NIH funds came to Washington state.
Nearly $1 billion. That sounds like a lot to me, but what could you actually buy for $1 billion?
I was looking this up, and you could buy a partial share, about half a share of the Seahawks for that money. But of course, Seahawks are not for sale, as far as I know.
Right, right. So those billion NIH dollars, where have they gone in Washington state?
About half of that $1 billion went to the University of Washington Medical School. And I asked John Scott about what he thinks those cuts would mean. He's chair of the pharmacology department at the University of Washington.
In the last century, the life expectancy has gone from about 48 to 80. And you can directly correlate that with advances in biomedical research. And as we're now at the stage where we're fighting diseases such as cancer, Alzheimer's, and diabetes, we really need this research to be able to move us to the next level when it comes to solving these more complicated diseases. And the proposed budget cuts are just going to stop that.
And what John Scott told me people don't necessarily realize is that as it is, medical researchers are running around trying to compete to get these medical research grants, only 10 or 15% of which are actually funded. So instead of doing medical research with most of their time, they're spending a lot of time on grants. This is just going to compound that problem. And that will affect not only them, but of course, the patients who benefit from this research.
Sure. And besides the University of Washington, where else did all that billion NIH dollars go?
I looked this up. Nearly 70 institutions in Washington state received NIH grants in 2016. Another big chunk went to the Fred Hutch Cancer Research Center, nearly $250 million in 2016. And Children's Hospital here in Seattle got $50 million last year. They came in third.
Okay. We've been talking with KUOW's David Hyde about cuts in President Trump's first proposed budget. But it's not just cuts, David. There are increases, too, in defense spending, of which we have a lot here. So how would that play out in Washington state if this proposal passes?
Again, we don't know for sure. Nobody's really talking about it. But it's a proposed $54 billion increase in defense spending in Trump's budget. And as you say, we've got a large military presence here in Washington state. It's not clear exactly what it's going to mean. We asked Representative Adam Smith about this. He's the ranking Democrat on the House Armed Services Committee. And in a statement today, Smith, who's a Democrat, of course, said there's more to national security than defense spending, and that gutting diplomacy while relying solely on the military would be devastating to our national security, presumably in part talking about cuts to the State Department.
And again, this is a proposal. Congress is going to have to act on this budget in some way.
Right, exactly. Congress can take this budget. It can leave this budget. They're the ones who ultimately decide.
Right. From KUOW's politics team, that's reporter David Hyde. Much more to come this week on this proposed budget, David.
Yeah, stay tuned.
You're listening to KUOW in Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Hunters, fishers, and environmental activists, not always mentioned in the same breath, but they are finding themselves together when it comes to public lands. Many outdoor folk consider hunting and fishing in these wild places to be their right, and they're nervous about calls to sell off or transfer public lands. Well, now they're crossing political lines to protect what they love, says reporter Jess Burns of EarthFix.
Talk to groups that represent hunters and anglers, and chances are you'll eventually hear something like this.
Hunters and anglers are the first conservationists.
Or this.
Hunters are the true conservationists in this country.
Or on the more nuanced side of things.
Those are the folks that are out on the landscape and see things and recognize things and have a deep appreciation for the wildlife.
That was Jesse Salisbury of Backcountry Hunters and Anglers, Dominic Aiello of the Oregon Outdoor Council, and Mark Holyoke of the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation. These groups often separate what they do, conservation, with what environmental groups do, preservation. The differences are there, but the larger goals are the same, healthy land and water that support wildlife. But when it comes to speaking up for these goals, it's the environmental groups that have taken the bullhorn most often. Hunters have been more familiar with this kind of horn. Elk call being demonstrated by Dan Clower at the Jackson County Sportsman Show in Southern Oregon.
You gotta really understand the language of the elk.
But it's the language of public lands policy that hunters are looking to master, even if it isn't comfortable territory. Ken Hand is Oregon Regional Director of the Mule Deer Foundation.
I'm not supposed to get into political issues, but we have to. I mean, you can't very well stay out of it. Yeah. No, I believe in keeping public land public. That's my viewpoint, and actually that's the viewpoint of Mule Deer Foundation, too.
This renewed urgency comes as elected officials in the West have pushed state and federal legislation to transfer federal lands to the states. It's prompted hunters and fishermen to take a break from the woods.
I hunt everything. So for me, it's really become just an ingrained part of who I am.
Angela Harlson, who lives in Portland, taught herself how to hunt in college. She recently joined Backcountry Hunters and Anglers. The group has seen a 25% increase in membership since the election. Harlson looked to Backcountry Hunters and Anglers because of its nonpartisan approach.
They will cross lines, and they will work with what you would, you know, maybe typically call the eco groups. And I think they're doing that in order to affect change.
In early March, several of Harlson's fellow group members joined environmental, outdoor recreation, and tribal groups in a large rally supporting public lands in Idaho. Yet not all hunter groups are game for a kumbaya with environmentalists.
So when we have multiple user groups like this, and we have a sector of that is unwilling to compromise, but asking the other side to constantly compromise, you have a very volatile relationship.
Dominic Aiello is director of the Oregon Outdoor Council, a hunting advocacy group funded by outdoor manufacturers.
We're at a point where we no longer want to work and compromise because it just doesn't work.
This sentiment feels similar to the voter anger and frustration that helped put Donald Trump in the White House. It's expressed in the anti-Obama, anti-Wolf, and politically pro-gun t-shirts and decals scattered around the sportsman show.
All right, get ready. Just pull the triggers, all you have to worry about.
Even within hunting and fishing groups, these deep political divides threaten to stymie the larger purpose. Elizabeth Higgs is a member of Oregon's Middle Rogue Steelheaders.
We all love the river, and I mean that's what we find in common, so we kind of look past the politics, and yeah, we just don't talk about the politics, talk about the fish.
It's this decision to put the politics aside and focus on preserving public lands that has put the bullhorn firmly in the clutches of hunters and fishermen. I'm Jess Burns, reporting.
This is KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Spring must be close because Sunday is the home opener for the Seattle Sounders. When that match is about to begin, the starting 11 are going to line up for America's national anthem and face a flag that is not their own in many cases. The Sounders captain is from Cuba. Their star midfielder is from Uruguay. The goalie is Swiss. The Sounders have players from Trinidad and Sweden and Panama. Now, none of those countries are covered by President Trump's immigration order, the one currently stalled in the courts. But our national immigration debate has reverberated across international soccer, and it is being felt in locker rooms around the league. All of that prompted one of our listeners to ask KUOW a question. Rex Andrew works in the Applied Physics Lab at the University of Washington. He's a big Sounders fan.
When you hear about the Trump's administration initiative in restricting maybe the number of foreign people employed here in favor of Americans, I think a lot about it because it's in the news all the time, but all of a sudden I was kind of looking over the roster of the Seattle Reign and the Seattle Sounders, and I thought, hey, a lot of these people are foreigners. How is that going to affect, in particular, soccer? And then I thought I would push the question to you guys.
Yeah, push it to us. That's what we do. Rex wants to know if local pro soccer players might get caught up in President Trump's immigration plans. Challenge accepted, Rex. KOW is on it, and we started by finding out what kind of visas athletes use to come to the U.S., because you hear a lot about the H-1B visa in Seattle, big in the tech industry. Athletes use a different type of visa called a P visa. Immigration lawyer Teddy Chadwick told us that landing an international player is kind of like landing an American player, at least at the start.
It would be the same way that they would for any individual who would just be here in the United States. You know, usually, typically that person has an agent if they are, you know, a really good star, if they're just playing for a foreign team. If they don't, they probably will get one really quickly once the Seattle Sounders make a call to their personal cell phone.
Right.
It's just the same process of background and contacting and, you know, negotiating what the contract will be. But then, you know, the additional step that would happen with a foreign national, presuming that, you know, they've already got a contract signed, everything's ready to go, at that point, the team needs to file a petition to bring him into the United States. Almost all of the immigration processes, when it's employer-related, have to be initiated by the employer. The player themselves can't start the process. And so the team would file a petition with the immigration service. That petition would go through. Typically, teams will do it with premium processing, which means it'll be done in about 2 weeks, at which point it will be sent over to the consulate or embassy of the country, and the player would then go to that consulate or embassy to do their visa interview and pick up their visa to come into the United States.
I also want to ask about H-1B visas. These are a big deal, especially in our Seattle area tech industry. We've been hearing about possible restrictions on H-1B visas, the idea being that the idea of the restriction being to favor American workers. Do you think something similar could happen with these P-1 visas?
Of course, I'm just guessing, but my pretty solid opinion on this is that no, it wouldn't happen with athlete visas, mostly because there's not a really big outcry of people who are afraid that a bunch of foreigners are coming in and taking American athlete jobs. I think that people around the U.S. are much more of a consumer of professional sports rather than a partaker of professional sports. You know, the number of people who watch, for instance, the NBA are way, 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 way higher than the number of people who are playing in the NBA.
Yes.
And the people who are then watching want to see the best athletes. They want to make sure that they have the very best product so that when they go pay for a ticket, they know they're seeing the very best that they can get. And so I don't see there being any sort of outcry toward, wow, you know, when you look at an NHL team, there's a whole lot of Canadians and a whole lot of Eastern Europeans on there. We need more Americans on that team. There's just not that outcry, and so I really don't see it likely that there would be any sort of ban put in place for P-1 visas.
Got it. Okay, now to the question that our listener asked, which was, will visas be revoked or denied for Seattle's foreign professional athletes? How likely is that to happen?
So it's extremely unlikely that any of the Seattle Sounders players are going to have their visas revoked, because none of them are from any of the countries that are on the proposed travel ban by Trump. In fact, just a quick survey of MLS players didn't show that anyone was from and held nationality from one of those travel ban countries. There's some MLS players that were hesitant because they're from Muslim countries, but none that held actual citizenship in those foreign countries. But that being said, I know with the MLS, there has been some concern with trying to bring in new talent, because what it's really had more of is a chilling effect on trying to bring in new individuals. The report that I read was from Grant Wall in Sports Illustrated, and he was stating that a Major League Soccer team was pursuing an individual from as a designated player from a foreign country, and that player backed out of negotiations saying, look, it doesn't look like it's a good time for me to come to the United States. I think I'm going to sign somewhere else. You know, and we don't know, because the report was a little vague on who was pursuing and even who they were pursuing, and so we don't know what specifically they were talking about. But, you know, it's very likely that an individual may have looked at our situation and said, you know what, it's not a good not a good time for me to come to the U.S. I think I'm going to go sign with, an English Premier League team or a Spanish team or something.
And that is immigration attorney Teddy Chadwick from the Greca Law Group in Wisconsin telling us about the possible effects or non-effects of immigration policy on teams like the Seattle Sounders, who, as I mentioned, are about to start their season. So it is not likely that Seattle athletes are going to have their visas taken away soon. We wondered what other ways could immigration policies affect our local sports teams. And to answer that, we have in the studio with us Steve Agin, founder of the Pacific Northwest Soccer podcast Radio Cascadia, Sounders fan, member of the Emerald City Supporters. Welcome, Steve.
Thank you so much for having me. Excited to be here.
We're excited to have you. And on the phone, another Steve, our friend Steve Clare, owner and editor of the soccer news site Prost America. Good to talk with you. Welcome, Steves.
Thank you, Bill, and congratulations on the success of your membership drive.
Oh, well, thank you for that. A pledge drive fan. Steves, let's imagine that the extreme happens, that P1 visas are restricted. Just to imagine that happening. There's Americans are crying out to have their sports played by Americans. And so American soccer teams aren't allowed to have as many international players on their rosters. We wondered, what effect would that have on our local soccer teams? Steve Agin, what do you think?
Most simply put, it's going to be a tremendous burden on the talent on the field, on the level of play. MLS has built itself up in the last 10 or 15 years, mostly via foreign talent. If you take all of that out of the league at once, you damage the league severely.
And Steve Clare, what effect would that have on American soccer as a whole?
Well, I think it would be disastrous. The sport is still growing, and although there are some fans who are very passionate for the homegrown players, by and large, people turn up to see the best in the world and famous names. I also think there's a side part to this, that no matter what American domestic foreign policy might be on this, 3 of the 22 teams in the league are in Canada and are not bound by it. So it would present the authorities with an incredible headache that 3 clubs had were able to procure players that was more difficult for the other 19. So I think, chaos is a probability, or is almost a certainty, and that's before you even consider that the American fan will feel badly let down because he is restricted, by grounds of religion or by grounds of nationality, from seeing the talent he wants to watch.
Let me ask you both, why is it that Americans aren't the best soccer players? Especially that's true on the men's team, right? But why are we talking about, what a letdown to have to watch Americans? Steve Clare, you first?
Well, you're talking about, I would never say such a thing for fear of being unable to go back to a stadium.
Yes.
But I think, first of all, it has to be said, soccer is a global game. A lot of the sports that are popular in the U.S. are played only by Americans, such as the NFL, or by a narrow pool of countries, such as hockey. So it's just a matter of numbers that the reason that Americans aren't the best in the world. So I think it's maybe just a matter of time. But also in the colleges, the best athletes are very highly sought after by many sports. And soccer isn't the best playing of one. So it's a combination of two things, the globalism of the game and the competition for great athletes from other sports.
Steve Agin, is that a foreigner just patronizing us? Why do you think Americans can't cut it?
No, not at all. No patronizing there. To be honest, people around the world have been developing soccer talent for a lot longer than we have, and it's naive to think that in 15 or 20 years we can develop players to the same level that somebody like FC Barcelona has been working on for 100 years.
But I was playing soccer when I was a kid. I have been hearing that soccer is sweeping the nation since I was a child. I'm 51 years old. When is this going to happen?
Well, at what point, did you start going to a soccer academy, play soccer for 4 or 5 hours a day instead of going to school? In Europe, it's at 7 years old.
Right.
Here, that just doesn't happen, and there's a huge gap in talent because of it.
Good point. Steve Clare, you grew up playing soccer, huh? Football.
Yeah,
football.
Yes, I did very much. So I grew up playing it. Well, I would even claim I learned to read. Reading soccer journalism, soccer match reports. That was 90% of the literature I consumed before I picked up a book. I would say this, that Washington State, as everybody knows, has more players per head. But soccer is still partially seen as a pastime as opposed to a career.
Hmm.
And I think I also will have to say that my fellow journalists tend to play up the soccer sweeping the nation thing. They have been saying that for a long time.
Yeah.
And I think you and I will probably go gray and maybe decompose before it actually happens.
We have cried wolf, yes. By the way, Steve Clare, we're talking really here about immigration and sports. We heard that from our immigration lawyer that it's unlikely that President Trump's immigration ban is going to have a big effect on soccer. Has the immigration ban, he did refer to some players, especially from majority Muslim countries, just being nervous about coming. Would you say that immigration talk has had any effect on Major League Soccer in America so far?
But not on Major League, well, notwithstanding the report that Teddy referred to on the Grant Wall player, I think that that is believed to be true. If you were a Muslim guy, a Muslim player, and you looked at what appeared to be the political climate in the U.S., you might think the same thing, notwithstanding that most of the MLS clubs are in probably left-leaning markets. I think it's more perception of the kind of country America is turning into. The rise in hate crimes, I mean, your local synagogue was vandalized. That America at the moment is just not a pleasant place to be foreign in at the moment. It's probably having a bigger problem in terms of perception than any rules or actual regulations.
We'll talk about that Seattle synagogue vandalism here in about 15 minutes. But Steve Agin, Mr. Clare mentioned left-leaning markets. Let's talk Sounders fans and how they have been reacting to this immigration debate.
You know, I think fans in the Pacific Northwest as a whole have always been left-leaning in their political views and willing to share them normally. And I don't really think that we've had any difference in this situation. It's been more pronounced in Vancouver and Portland, but folks in Seattle are unhappy at the prospect of anything abridging the talent or the joy that they get out of their game.
Let's go to the KOW listener who we heard from the very beginning of this segment. Rex Andrew came to the studio to listen to the answers to his questions. Hi, Rex.
Hi.
What did you learn?
Oh, I thought the two Steves gave a really interesting perspective that we don't really appreciate, we normal fans. And I would have one question for them. I'm wondering if they think that globalization would improve the skill level of domestic players and improve our chances in world competitions.
Anyone? Globalization.
I think it has already.
I think by globalization, Rex, are you referring to more American players playing in other leagues?
Or vice versa, more foreign players playing in America?
That's a really good question. I would say bringing in mediocre players to Major League Soccer actually stops the pipeline of American players getting spaces in the team. And despite my origins, Rex, I actually don't think bringing in... I'm speaking as an over-the-hill, over-age, overweight European myself, but I think they belong in the press box rather than on the field. And I don't honestly think the importation of Steve Gerrard or Ashley Cole helps American soccer. However, on the contrary, I probably, and I know Sounders fans will definitely not forgive me for this, I think in the long-term best interests of the United States, Jordan Morris would improve quicker playing abroad. But, that's a hard argument to make in Seattle after his heroics of last season.
KOW listener Rex Andrew, it's time for our performance review. Did we answer your question?
Oh, I think you did great. Thanks.
Well, thank you for the question. Again, Rex came in and asked a local wonder question, how might immigration policy affect our beloved sports teams here? And any final words, Steve Agin?
I'd just say that on the point of globalization, I think that bringing in youth academy coaches and helping our players learn the game from a younger age is ultimately what's going to bring American soccer to the forefront. And if this executive order has anything to do with that, anything with affecting that, we'll see pushback in MLS.
That's the founder of the Pacific Northwest Soccer Podcast, Radio Cascadia, member of the Emerald City Supporters, Steve Agin. Thank you, Steve.
Thank you so much for having me.
Steve Clare, any more final words on globalism and the pitch?
Well, I want to, if I may, broaden it out to sport as a whole, where there has been a concrete example that I think the listeners might like to know. Amateur wrestling is a very, very big sport in Iran, which is on the banned list, and they were holding the World Championships in February. The day Trump's executive order came out, they actually said they would refuse visas to the U.S. wrestling team. They then said they would grant them when that executive order was overturned by the Seattle court the next day.
Hmm.
In the end, the American athletes were allowed to travel because the ban wasn't in order, and they got a rapturous reception from Iranian wrestling fans. In fact, American wrestler Jordan Burroughs apparently has more Twitter followers in Tehran than in the United States. So I think we lose a chance to put the best face on America abroad. The other thing to watch out for is, I think the LA Olympic bid is under severe threat from this. They will decide on that in September. this year with Trump still in office, with Paris being the only other competitor now, I think there's a great chance that LA might lose an Olympics, that the Paris attacks had made them hot favor for, and therefore a stream of revenue that we can't begin to calculate. And the effects on American athletics, American sport, could be huge if they lose to Paris in September.
Steve Clare, owner, editor of the soccer news site Prost America. Thank you, Steve.
You're welcome.
And thank you, KUW listener Rex Andrew, for asking a question that helps all of us learn. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Bill.
More of KUW's The Record in just a moment. KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. I'm Bill Radke. You know, if you think ballet is all tutus and stuffy 19th century stories, I invite you to think again, because this weekend, Seattle's Pacific Northwest Ballet is presenting three contemporary works. The bill includes the Seattle premiere of a new ballet called Her Door to the Sky by a choreographer named Jessica Lang. KUOW's arts and culture reporter Marcy Silman is here to tell you why this ballet is a big deal. Hi, Marcy.
Hey, Bill.
Let's begin with that choreographer. I know Jessica Lange is not the actress. Who is Jessica Lange?
She's not that. This one's a little bit younger. She's a 42-year-old New York-based choreographer. She's got her own dance company. Some of our listeners may have seen her. She brought them here to Meany Hall last fall. They were amazing. She's a Juilliard grad, and she used to dance with Twyla Tharp, who other people may know. She's done Broadway work as well as ballet.
Oh, yes. Billy Joel and so much, much, much more. Now, the ballet that Jessica Lange has made for PNB is called Her Door to the Sky. What is it about?
Well, loosely, it's based on a series of paintings that that Georgia O'Keeffe made in the 1930s and 40s. But Lange told me earlier this week that it's not about Georgia O'Keeffe. It's really more of a musing about the history of women and creativity and women in the arts. And then Lange told me that we really shouldn't focus so much on gender when it comes to art.
I get interviewed quite a lot about being a female choreographer, to which I sometimes am surprised that that's a common conversation. And I just wasn't raised, both in my training and as a person, I wasn't raised to consider my gender as being something that would set me apart. Now I recognize where I am and what the reality of the ballet world is, and that the commissions tend to favor men. And that imbalance is not in modern dance. In ballet, I don't know if it's just the time we live, but it is heavy on male choreographers.
And Marcy, why does she say ballet is heavy on male choreographers?
Well, that, Bill, is the $6 million question. Great question. And nobody had a real precise answer for me when I asked them. Sexism, or maybe Jessica Lange said, perhaps women are less likely to push themselves into the spotlight than their male colleagues. Interestingly, she told me that Pacific Northwest Ballet's repertoire is more women-friendly than some of the other companies she's worked with. So I decided to ask PNB's artistic director, Peter Boll, why that was. And first off, he gave me a long list of all the ballets that were made by women that are in the repertoire. There's a lot of them. Twyla Tharp has six. Our current fave, Crystal Pite, has two. She's making a new one next season. And here's something else that he wrote via email. He says, it's important to provide both the opportunity and the encouragement for young female choreographers, and PNB's made this a priority over the past decade.
Pacific Northwest Ballet commissioned Jessica Lange to make this dance for the company. What does that mean?
It means that Peter Boll invited her to make a dance specifically for the dancers of this company. Now, she works really all over the world. She's made ballets for everybody. But she told me that she thought that the dancers in Seattle were really something special.
You know, they're proficient on point and then also barefoot. You know, they can roll to the ground. They are technically proficient at classical ballet, but they have an energy and there's an excitement about their movement quality. I'm excited to see them, not only in my work, but in other people's work. I see a diversity and a range that isn't typical of most ballet companies.
Jessica's excited, and Marcy, I know you're excited. You are a ballet nerd. Mm-hmm. You love this stuff. Mm-hmm. I want to know, why should somebody who's maybe less geeked out on ballet as you, why should someone else buy a ticket to see this happen?
Because I think if you open yourself up to something new, that you're really going to love it. The dancers are athletic as well as beautiful. People are jumping all over the stage, and there's a live orchestra, so that's wonderful. I know people say, this stuff's totally not for me. And Jessica Lange says some people even find ballet scary.
I think that they're terrified of dance. That's true. I think they're constantly questioning, what is it about? What am I missing? Tell me, is there a narrative I should be following? If we can just keep reassuring them that dance is meant to be an expressive form that is meant to convey whatever it is the viewer wants to see. So you have your story ballets, of course, that you need to read your synopsis to follow. But contemporary dance has potential to reach anyone and everyone, and has a quality to it that can affect your life if you, the viewer, are participating in watching it.
So if you have never been to a ballet, I know you have, but mm-hmm. if you never had this program, Director's Choice is a great entree. There's two other dances on the bill, one by the world-famous William Forsythe, another by a guy named David Dawson. And also, PMB's dancers are right up there with the best in the world, not just in this area. It's one of the best companies in the world. Plus, if there's not incentive, you can come with me on Saturday afternoon at 2. We are bringing our Front Row Center program there, and the post-show conversation with Sarah Ricard-Orza, a beautiful dancer who's in all the posters. Peter Bowl will be there, and you can get a half-price ticket. So what more could you want?
Marcy Silman, Front Row Center, Saturday afternoon at 2 o'clock. One more thing, Marcy, slightly different topic here. We were talking earlier with KUOW's politics reporter, David Hyde, about the Trump administration's proposed budget cuts. And I have heard that those cuts proposed include totally eliminating the National Endowment for the Arts. I figured you would know how that might affect local organizations like Pacific Northwest Ballet.
Well, just to give you an idea, the NEA gave almost $1 million in arts funding to 34 groups across the state. Just last fall, it funded everything from the King County Creative Justice Program, which is an alternative to youth incarceration, also funds Seattle Public Schools Creative Advantage Program, which is designed to provide parity in arts education across the district. PNB got money, Seattle Symphony, Seattle Opera, small groups like the South Asian Film Festival got some money. Now, there's also more than money. The Seattle Art Museum wrote me, yes, they got funding, but they took advantage of something called the Federal Indemnification Program. And essentially what that is a help with big shows. For example, the Picasso show that was here a few years ago, Gauguin show. It costs money to insure those artworks to bring them to this country. The NEA provides these museums around the country with help so that something might happen to one of these artworks, the museums are covered so that we in the Seattle area can see these great artworks without having to buy a ticket to go to Europe to do that.
That is part of the National Endowment for the Arts you never thought about. KUOW's Marcy Silman, arts and culture reporter. Thanks a lot, Marcy.
Always great to be here, Bill.
And with you, too. We're going to be talking about President Trump's budget, NEA, and much more later this afternoon on KUOW's All Things Considered. And we have a link to a discount for you for that performance that we talked about with Marcy Silman, a 50% ticket discount. So hi thee to KUOW.org right now. Search for Front Row Center, or you can just go to Twitter. We are tweeting that link out now at KUOW. KUOW Seattle, I'm Bill Radke. I'd like to turn with you now to a story about bridging America's divisions. There is a new project happening in Seattle called Eat with Muslims. And here's how it works. A Muslim family hosts a meal in their home and invites people from all faiths and cultures to join. Neighbors, coworkers, total strangers. KUOW's producer Andy Hurst went to one of these dinners in Seattle's Belltown neighborhood and talked with some people there, beginning with Somali-American filmmaker and writer Fatia Absia. She is the project's co-founder.
What inspired me to do this is because our country is so divided, and you hear, you know, there's a lot of hateful rhetoric that has been coming out of, you know, the campaign, and I wanted to make sure the people who think that Muslims are an American, or, you know, they're so different from us. I wanted to give people a chance to kind of get to know their fellow neighbors. Nothing beats fear like face. And it's so true. Once you talk to someone, all the differences you think you might have kind of just melt away, and our commonality just start revealing itself.
I guess humans are tribal still. And if somebody shows up that's not part of the tribe, people are just automatically cautious. And what face-to-face meeting and sharing food does is give you a chance to realize the fact that we're all human, and we all want the same things.
The one good thing that's come out of the present political climate is that people are getting together that would never have gotten together before. So we have to come together, and we have to explore each other's cultures.
I grew up here since I was 5, and so I see myself as an American. And sometimes when I see the news and people, you know, use the label just by saying Muslims instead of saying, you know, like citizens, or that's when I realize that, oh, other people don't see me as one of them, you know. So I'm hoping that if I come out and I just be myself, that people can see that I'm just like them.
Well, let me put it in context. I mean, I think that the Trump administration has used the ban and all this attacks on immigrants and Muslims. They've used terrorism as their excuse. I think that this is a reflection of a change in mass sentiment. No longer will the boogeyman of terrorism separate us.
In my life, I have met people who would tell me, oh my God, you're not the real Muslim. You know, are you really Muslim? And I'm like, yeah, I pray 5 times a day. I'm a devout Muslim. And they would say, but you don't seem like the Muslims we heard, you know, about, or the Muslims we see on TV. And it really changed their point of view and how they feel towards Muslims, and became a very good friends of mine. So I know this works. Talking to people and sharing our stories totally, totally works. We just need to give each other a chance. And I also think, even people, Trump supporters, I don't think it's fair to alienate people. How are we going to make our world better if you can't fight intolerance with intolerance? We have to have open minds, and we have to reach out.
That is Fatia Absia, co-founder of Eat with Muslims. And you also heard from David Shop and Mita Wardani and Judy Pansulo and Elsa Marie Butler in an event that happened on March 4th in Seattle. That story was produced by Andy Hurst with KUOW's immigration team, and you'll find more of their stories at KUOW.org. And you heard the diners there talking about, they use the word tribalism to describe what seems to them like an increasing atmosphere of bigotry, of us-them, not just affecting our Muslim friends. In Seattle recently, someone vandalized a synagogue, Temple Hersh Sinai on Capitol Hill. On an outside wall of the synagogue, somebody spray-painted the words, "The Holocaust is fake history," and they wrote the letter S as a dollar sign. The rabbi at Temple Hersh Sinai is Daniel Wiener, and he's sitting next to me. Welcome, Rabbi.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
First of all, what did those spray-painted words mean to you when you saw them?
You know, intellectually, unfortunately, we've been expecting this. It wasn't a surprise, but to actually see it in black and white was really viscerally a gut check. It was really disturbing and troubling and disappointing.
What do you mean you expected this?
With everything that's been going on over the last few months around the country, not only with other vulnerable populations, but particularly the Jewish community and all of these bomb threats that are now into the hundreds, many of us felt it was just a matter of time before these things would affect our community as well. But to actually see it in such a vicious and malicious kind of in all of its glory in that sense was immensely troubling, and I was a bit unprepared for that emotionally.
Hmm. The words that the spray painter used, that the Holocaust is fake history, did you think of fake news and the discussion we're having around Facebook and media and President Trump?
Oh, absolutely. When I saw that text, it seemed to me to be the work of someone who exercised some deliberation. There was, of course, Holocaust denial. There was the sense of the stereotypical connection of Jews with money.
Because of the dollar sign on the S.
Exactly. Yeah. But the fake history component, absolutely, I saw in that a meme that has been popularized by our president.
Have you ever tried to imagine in your mind who that spray painter is? Because doesn't it feel different if it's a neo-Nazi versus a teenage prankster versus a mentally ill person? Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I think there is some degree of a distinction that comes from that intentionality. But by the same token, the impact and the hurt that it engenders is makes it difficult to completely empathize or get inside the head of someone who would do this. There is a sense, though, that the writing was very meticulous and was highly symbolic. So this was more than a teenager just writing something derogatory about Jews. This required kind of multiple levels of understanding some of the tropes of white supremacy.
I understand somebody hung a bed sheet over the graffiti at first. The sheet said, "Love wins," and you had it taken down. Why?
I did. I actually was an email conversation with the person who put that up and expressed my deepest, deepest appreciation for his intention. However, I thought it was very important, particularly just for that one day on Friday, that the community understand that this is going on, that this is part of a larger concern that all of us should be struggling with in our nation. And I didn't want to just sweep this under the rug. I didn't want this just to be seen as the new normal or as just some kind of minor vandalism. I think it's important that people understand this is part of a larger pattern and that we have to appreciate that pattern and do what we can to resist it.
What did you tell your congregants the next day?
The next day, really two messages. One message was, certainly we are heartbroken about the fact that this happened. We assured our congregation that our existing security was substantial and that we would be looking at expanding that security so that they know that when they come to celebrate, to worship, to learn with us, that they're going to be safe and they're going to be okay. But the key thing that I wanted to share was, you know, we received over 1,000 expressions of support and solidarity from around the world, literally. And the universal message from all was that not only do we stand with you, but we want you to understand that this is not really how the world is, that the vast majority of people love you, that support you, support other vulnerable populations, And that the people who did this were a small, narrow, toxic minority. And so that perspective broadening was very helpful and comforting, and I shared that with the congregation.
We're talking with Rabbi Daniel Wiener at Temple Daher Sinai, which was vandalized recently. And you say you got support from all over the world. Is this an internationally important incident? The sad thing is I can't tell anymore when an incident flies under the radar and when it really gets people's attention. Do you know what I mean? We just hear so much about bomb threats, right? The evacuation on Mercer Island. And do you think that the country and the world is looking at Temple Daher Sinai and those words, that photo?
I think because it occurred within a larger context, both in terms of threats and attacks within this country, but also a larger context in terms of America's renewed image in the world as being not quite as welcoming, as being more tribal and discriminating and nationalistic than it had been before. I mean, I think it resonated and touched a nerve because of the larger context.
What was it like writing that sermon? I mean, you had to decide. I imagine you with your fingers poised above a keyboard, you know, deciding, well, I could characterize this different ways. What was that like for you?
You know, I had actually written a couple different messages and recorded some messages. There wasn't one sermon per se, but trying to find a way to embrace the reality and the troubling nature of it, but at the same time to understand that there's a redemptive component to this, that there was a constructive element to this, that we are a part of a larger, not just a majority within this nation, but a larger community of vulnerable populations and of faith communities that truly are willing to stand up and to resist this. And I think that's the key message, is this kind of anti-Semitism pre-existed the last few months, although there's been a significant uptick. I think there's a correlation, not a causation, to what's been going on in terms of leadership. But yeah, I mean, I think I wanted to be sure that we embrace the severity of it, but by the same token, we're able to rise above it and find a way to affirm relationships and bonds and to redouble our courage and our convictions to fight against it.
You talk about rising above these hateful incidents. You know, I noticed your Twitter handle is Rockin' Rabbi Danny, you know, and I've learned you're a huge Grateful Dead fan, and there's so many other things you want to be talking about and projecting. How do you do that? How do you think about all that?
You know, I think without being too much of a faith leader here, I think I embrace what the book of Ecclesiastes says, and that is that there is a time for everything. There is a time to celebrate and to have fun and to be lighter, and then there's a time when the need arises to have to confront a crisis, confront challenges such as those that we're facing now in this country.
So are we going to see you and other Jewish congregants and Jewish members of our local community being more visible with Muslims and immigrants and just people of all walks of life?
It will be a continuation of what's already existed. One of the great things, I use great kind of relatively, one of the great things to emerge also from this incident is the fact that it wasn't this incident that brought us together, that there have been some incredibly enduring and building relationships between the Jewish community and the Christian community, the Muslim community, all faith communities. And so we had an existing relationship upon which to draw support and sustenance from one another. It wasn't as if this is the thing that brought us together. For example, when the MAPS Mosque was defaced up in Redmond a few mm-hmm. months ago, members of the Jewish community, really, men, Jewish leaders, were some of the first to extend ourselves and to be there for that community.
Yeah, that mosque ended up partnering with the Mormon church next door, and we had both of officials from both places in at our studio talking about it. You know, Rabbi, you told us that you said thwarting persecution is not a hook on which to hang your identity. What do you mean by that?
I think particularly for the Jewish community, we faced persecution throughout our history. To forge one's identity merely upon a notion of resisting those who are out to get us is, in essence, allowing our enemies and those who want to destroy us to define us. I mean, we have to be vigilant and we have to stand up when necessary, but the reason to be Jewish and the reason to cultivate one's connection to Jewish ideals and to the Jewish community should be proactive reasons, life-affirming reasons, not merely to thwart persecution. And I just think that's something I think that other vulnerable communities also struggle with, is how much to fight back, but also not wanting that to become the central dynamic in our existence and in our identity.
Is that a conversation you have with other minority groups these days?
Yeah, it's a growing conversation, but it's one that we've been having within the Jewish community for forever.
Sure. How different do you think it would feel if you were a rabbi in a much more Jewish city than Seattle is? You know, in New York, Miami, Philly, L.A. I mean, do you think about your identity, your place in the community, particularly in Seattle, where it's just not the same as some of these other places?
No. I think you're absolutely right that in Seattle, it is, one has to be more actively engaged to be Jewish. One can't take it for granted as one might in New York City or other large metropolitan areas. And so there is a more acute sense of our distinctiveness from other populations, and in an acute sense that we are a relatively small population within this community. And I think there are some ways in which we see ourselves and see ourselves as part of the larger community that emanate from that.
We've been talking about bigotry. What do you do about it? What do you want a listener to do about it?
I think the most important thing is to, to continue to be vigilant, to not allow the more dramatic or even the more mundane expressions of bigotry and prejudice to go unchallenged. I think it's critical that we support any kind of legislation that punishes hate crimes to the full extent of the law. And I think education and exposure is also really important. The ways in which more and more diverse communities can interact with one another, as in your previous story about having a meal with a Muslim, mm-hmm. to actually have some real experience experiences and to learn about other cultures, the ways in which they're distinct and the ways in which they share common values with us. That kind of education is always one of the greatest remedies and antidotes to bigotry and to prejudice.
Rabbi Daniel Weber, Rabbi Daniel Weiner from Temple to Hersh Sinai on Capitol Hill. We're talking about vandalism at your synagogue and more. Do you ever get sick of this conversation? You ever just think, this is ridiculous? This is not what I want to wake up in the morning and even go on the radio and discuss.
You know, in some ways, we've been kind of in a golden age. We really haven't been experiencing it as intensively as we seem to have been experiencing in the last few months. Quite frankly, one of the most heartbreaking things for me is my parents' and grandparents' generation experienced institutional, you know, and attitudinal anti-Semitism. I really didn't experience growing up, and many of my contemporaries didn't.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in San Francisco.
Uh-huh.
But now my children and my children's generation are experiencing it in a way that's akin to what my parents and grandparents experienced. So that is incredibly disheartening.
Really? You think that's where we are? We are where your grandparents were in that sense?
I think we're moving in that direction. It may be coming from different sources, but I think if we do not get a handle on this, we are going to, in some ways, go back to the quote-unquote bad old days. I certainly hope that doesn't happen. I think there is time to turn this around. But I do feel a sense of intense disappointment that what for me seemed like a moral trajectory and evolution toward greater understanding and greater acceptance seems to have taken a regressive U-turn over the past few months.
Yeah, that's a bigger picture, isn't it? A lot of people are thinking about a moral trajectory, as you said, that maybe they took for granted.
Absolutely.
So this, finally, this vandalism at your synagogue is being investigated now, investigated as a hate crime, but we'll wait and see what comes of the criminal look into this. But we've been talking with Rabbi Daniel Weiner about not just vandalism, but hopefully about more, hopefully about our hopes, our better selves. And we hope you can come in and talk about bigger ideals next time we meet.
Very positive and constructive ones, I hope.
Indeed. You're listening to KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. Daniel Weiner, can we go out on some Grateful Dead?
Let's do
it. Lighten it up a little
bit.
You've been to how many concerts?
In the 150.
In the hundreds. Okay, how about some music? Thanks, Rabbi.
Thank you.